Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is on a 5-day trip to northern and western Africa. The trip will take him to 4 countries, Algeria, Mauritania, Senegal, and Mali. His visit is the latest effort by Turkey to project its influence across the continent and strengthen its presence worldwide. Since 2005, as then Prime Minister, Erdogan has been working to deepen ties with Africa. Emre Çalışkan is with the Department of Politics and International Relations at Oxford University in Britain. He says Erdogan has been to Africa 12 times since becoming president in 2009. He notes his trips had several objectives, such as economic growth, expanding Turkey's influence in the world, and the use of Islam. Earlier this month, Turkey welcomed a group of African ministers for a week of meetings. Such gatherings are part of a Turkish effort to improve contacts with African leaders. Over the past 10 years, Turkey has tripled the number of embassies across Africa. Even with all the Turkish investments, the economic returns have been less than what the government expected. And that has led Turkey to reconsider its priorities, says Mehmet Arda. He studies Africa for the Istanbul-based public policy center, EDAM.
When we look at the Turkish trade with Africa, it's basically the same as it was about 10 years ago. So it is more a way of projecting itself as a power in the world. Moreover, Turkey puts itself as the friend, at least, of the countries which are the left behind, the destitute and all that. So I think from that point of view as well, it fits with that model of Turkey projecting itself on the world stage.
In his recent visits to Africa, President Erdogan has added Islamic subjects to his message. His speeches have sometimes been colored with criticism of the West and talk of its colonial past. At one time, the Turkish Ottoman Empire also extended to Africa. Çalışkan says that appealing to African Muslims offers Turkey a chance for important diplomatic gains as well as risks.
50% of the African countries come from Muslim backgrounds. And this gives leverage for Turkey in the eyes of Europe, in the eyes of West, and in the eyes of Africa.
But he notes a competition among Islamic groups and countries such as Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. Historically, he says, these nations are very influential among Africa's Muslim communities. Çalışkan describes Turkey as a newcomer and says the country wants to expand its influence. Last September, Turkey opened its largest overseas military base in Somalia. Some observers say the opening of the base is a sign that Turkish officials have aspirations for the area. The Turkish Navy is expanding, with the government planning to build an aircraft carrier. Egypt has expressed concern about Turkey's agreement with Sudan to redevelop the Sudanese island of Suakin. The island was once home to the Ottoman Empire's main naval base. The Turkish government says it has no plans to develop Suakin for military purposes. But Çalışkan says such denials will do little to reduce tensions given the level of mistrust between Erdogan and Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Observers warn the competition in the Middle East is already spilling into Africa. They say this process is likely to continue because of Turkey's growing commitment to the continent and its effort to become a global player.
Chinese media say the Communist Party has proposed lifting term limits for the office of president from China's constitution. Under the proposal, party leader Xi Jinping could continue serving as president after the year 2023. China's official Xinhua news agency published a report on the proposed constitutional amendment package Sunday. It said the Communist Party of China supported plans to drop the 2 consecutive terms limit to the offices of the president and vice president. Term limits have been part of the constitution since 1982. The Communist Party also proposed adding Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era to the Constitution. This will make Xi the 3rd Chinese leader to have such an honor. In the past, the Constitution was amended to include Mao Zedong thought and Deng Xiaoping theory. Xi is expected to be elected to a 2nd 5-year term as president at a meeting of the National People's Congress. The proposals will likely be approved at that meeting, which opens on March 5th. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Tobacco is the only legal drug that kills many of its users when used exactly as intended by manufacturers. That is the first sentence of the World Health Organization's 2015 Global Report on Smoking Trends Around the World. On its website, the World Health Organization says that in 2015, over 1.1 billion people smoked tobacco. The organization also states that while tobacco use is decreasing in many countries, it appears to be increasing in WHO Eastern Mediterranean region and the African region. The WHO lists on its website these 3 important facts about tobacco use. Tobacco kills up to half of its users. Tobacco kills more than 7 million people each year. More than 6 million of those deaths
are from direct tobacco use. Around 890,000 non-smokers die from secondhand smoke. Nearly 80% of the world's more than 1 billion smokers live in low and middle-income countries. In 2016, the World Bank report, The Global State of Smoking in 5 Charts, said that from 2000 to 2015, smoking rates went up in 27 countries. The report said most of them were low and middle-income countries. The report added that in Indonesia, the rate went up by almost 30%. It said more than 70 million people smoke in Indonesia. The WHO says there is a tobacco crisis. Experts say that if we do nothing to change this trend, the number of people who die from tobacco each year worldwide will rise to 8 million by 2030. The article also states that in every country, the smoking rates for men are much higher than those for women. The American Lung Association says fewer Americans smoke cigarettes now than before tobacco control policies were established. In its yearly report, the ALA says smoking rates among adults and teens are at historic lows. It says a little more than 15.5% of American adults and 8% of high school students smoke cigarettes. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the U.S. also researches smoking rates. It says the rates in the U.S. decreased from 20.9% in 2005 to 15.5% in 2016. Connie Graffender is director of the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health. She says more people are quitting, and those who continue to smoke are smoking less. However, CDC research also shows that almost 38 million American adults still smoke. And the American Lung Association says tobacco use and exposure to secondhand smoke affects some groups and areas of the United States more than others. Thomas Carr is the director of national policy for the American Lung Association and writer of its 2018 report, The State of Tobacco Control. Carr says smoking rates are close to 30% or higher among poor people, less educated people, Native Americans, and some other ethnic groups. Carr says that the tobacco industry advertises more to some of these groups. He adds that often there are more tobacco products available in stores in low-income areas. Teenagers are more likely to smoke if their friends or parents smoke. Studies show that most people who smoke start before they are 18. Some start as young as age 11, according to the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Carr calls it a childhood disease. It starts in your teens, and then once you're hooked, you can't get off of it. The American Lung Association advocates for the U.S. government to make buying tobacco products for those under age 21 illegal. The group says this would lead to a drop in the number of young smokers. The ALA says if middle and high school students cannot get cigarettes, they are less likely to start smoking. To date, 5 states in the U.S., California, Oregon, Maine, Hawaii, and New Jersey, have raised the age to 21. The WHO says that there are other things countries can do to limit tobacco use. Experts at the WHO say studies show that anti-tobacco advertisements can reduce the number of children who smoke. This is especially true if the advertising uses picture warnings on the packaging. The WHO adds that bans on tobacco advertising can reduce the use of tobacco products. Higher taxes can also lower the number of people who use tobacco. This is especially true with young and poor people. The CDC says smokers die, on average, 10 years earlier than non-smokers. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The attorney general said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claimed to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The president finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent. He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression, and he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. "If there is," he said, "then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time."
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.